basically, top tip for health span is to exercise, first of all, and to do it at least a few times a week at an intensity that's much higher than we would do it comfortably. So if you go at a self-selected pace, it's going to be okay. If you go harder than you'd like to go because you're chasing a little critter around and you're having a great time running after them, that's going to be much, much better if you find yourself out of breath.
Welcome to Longevity by Design, a podcast designed to give individuals access to the leading scientific information in the field of longevity. The ability to add years to your life and life to your years needs no opinion. Join us as we ask science to take the wheel. In each episode, Dr. Gil Blander joins a co-host and an industry expert in the field of longevity, shining a light and getting the answers to the key question, how can we live a longer, healthier life?
Hello, I'm Ashley Reaver, and I'm joined by Dr. Gil Blander. Welcome to Longevity by Design, How to Live a Longer, Healthier Life. We're produced by Inside Tracker, your science-based guide to optimizing your body from the inside out. Our guest today is Dr. Keith Barr, who will discuss the effects of exercise and nutrition on muscle, tendons, and ligaments, and how they relate to health and performance as we age. Dr. Barr received his bachelor's in kinesiology from the University of Michigan, a master's degree in muscle physiology from the University of California, Berkeley, and his PhD from the University of Illinois, where he discovered the molecular signal that causes muscle to grow bigger in response to resistance exercise. He did his postdoctoral research at Washington University in St. Louis, where he identified the molecular signal that leads to increased capillaries and mitochondria in muscle in response to endurance exercise. He then returned to Michigan with Dr. Robert Dennis, where he learned to engineer skeletal muscle and extended the work to include the heart, the first functional smooth muscle organoids, and the first engineered tendons. Keith opened his first laboratory at the University of Dundee in Scotland, where his group engineered the first ligaments from bone to bone. Dr. Barr is currently the head of the Functional Molecular Biology Laboratory at the University of California, Davis. His research is focused on determining the effect of exercise, nutrition, age, and disease on musculoskeletal tissue function. Work from his lab spans from the molecular mechanisms to lead to adaptation to human studies to translate these basic discoveries to interventions that improve longevity and quality of life. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a great pleasure to be here.
Thank you so much. And Keith, we always like to start by the beginning. And the first question is, what made you to become a scientist?
So like pretty much every exercise physiologist, I became a scientist to figure out why I wasn't a great athlete. So most of those of us who are in this field are good athletes who are pretty driven as far as their athletic pursuits, but they weren't great. Like George Brooks at Ashley's University, he was a national level runner, but could never become an international level runner. And so he tried to figure out why. Somebody told him it was because of lactate. And he's now spent something like 50 years trying to figure out what lactate does to the body. So we're all a little bit driven by trying to figure out what our weaknesses were.
And what about the muscular skeletal system kind of as a whole, if we're starting back to your exercise physiology?
Yeah, so basically, beginning. What most people don't understand are everybody thinks about health and they think, oh, you know, there's cancer, there's heart disease and all of these horrible things. And people fail to realize that almost 20% of Americans who die, they actually die from their inactivity. And if you look at it on a broader scale, as far as the cost to the economy, musculoskeletal injuries to the neck and back or to the whole body actually cost more to the U.S. economy than heart disease and diabetes combined. So the fact is that the 1 in 3 visits to a doctor is because you've had a tendon, muscle, or connective tissue injury. And so there's this huge, huge component of our society that is, you know, we'll say go out and exercise. Everybody knows that all you have to do is exercise. It's going to improve your longevity. It's going to improve all of these things. But so many people are injured and can't do it that it becomes really, really, really difficult to actually to provide that kind of evidence-based work to say, look, this is how you can move forward.
Yeah. And Keith, that's a very good point. And if you look at the cause of death at a very old age, 70%, I think, from the cause of death is basically a fall that you break your hip and then you die, I don't know, 6 or 7 months later. So I think that your point is a very good one, and not a lot of people are thinking about it. Yeah. So can you explain to our listener, what is the muscular skeletal system?
Sure.
And why is it, I think that you already explained why it's so vital for us, but maybe.
Yeah, so really what we talk about when we talk about musculoskeletal, a lot of people focus on the skeleton, like everybody has a sense of what osteoporosis is and why it's important to have stronger bones. As you said, critical falls, hip breaks are a really big problem in the elderly. But long before that happens, our muscles don't work on their own. So you can have somebody who looks really impressive, lots of muscle mass, but they actually don't produce a good amount of force. Because what we have to do is we have to connect that muscle to the bone in order for our body to move. And if we do that and we have a big muscle and a really bad ligament or a really bad tendon or a really bad bone that we're trying to pull on, or that there's cartilage damage within the joint, the movement is not going to be the way it's supposed to be. And the result is that we're not going to move properly, and it's going to be painful. And when we move and it's painful, we don't move as much as we should. There's a really nice study in NFL football players that shows that if an NFL football player ruptures their ACL during their career, relative to every other NFL player who doesn't rupture their ACL, they have a 50% higher likelihood of a heart attack.
Wow.
We also know that if you are in the strongest third of the population, you're one quarter as likely to die between 40 and 60 of cancer. We know that 30% or a third of all people who die from cancer actually die because they're too weak to do their activities of daily living, and they're too weak to continue their life. So the idea that our muscle strength, it's actually in humans, it's the greatest correlation between your longevity is your muscle strength. So that's the one factor that actually correlates best with your longevity. There's a really nice study on Hawaiians, 44-year longitudinal study. If you're in the strongest third of the population in your mid-40s to 50s, you are 2.5 times more likely to make it to 100 years of age. So again, there's this truism that only the strong survive. It's actually a literal truism. So your strength is actually going to be one of your primary determinants for how long you live. And it's not total absolute strength, like if you have to be able to lift a car. It's your strength relative to your size, because you have to be able to do those activities that are going to allow you to be able to move, to do your activities of daily living, to do the things you want to do to make your life that much more enriching, so that you'll do everything else you need to do in order to live longer.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more about the strengths. What about endurance? Is endurance important?
So endurance is important, but it doesn't work the same way. So if you're in the if you have the highest in that same longitudinal study on Hawaiian, if you're in the highest third of endurance capacity, it only gave you a 10% more greater likelihood of making it to 100 relative to the strength giving you a 2.5 times. So 250% greater likelihood. So the endurance is really good, but again, a lot of it goes down to what are your historical familial weaknesses. So if you have problems with neurocognitive and you have problems with cardiovascular, then endurance is going to be really important, because we know that endurance exercise increases brain function, specifically in the hippocampus, and that even basic exercise like walking is going to improve heart function. But if you are somebody who has family history of cancer or other issues that are going to be detrimental to, you know, to your longevity as well, those things are going to be much more dependent on the strength component. And one of the other interesting things, if you go back into the literature, so that famous Dr. Morris, who is a Scottish doctor who did the ticket takers versus the bus drivers on the London city buses, and the bus drivers who sat all day, they had much higher rates of heart attacks than the ones who went up and down the stairs and took tickets all day. So the activity, that was the first one that really kind of indicated that activity was important. The interesting thing that nobody ever realizes is his two or three studies later, he showed that if you are in a heavy work, and what he talked about there was machinists and people who are lifting really heavy weights in their work, they actually had a much, much higher or much lower rate of heart death from heart disease than those people who he said did light work. And for him, light work was the mailman, the person who walked all over the place delivering all the mail. So even early on, we learned that the endurance component, yeah, it's good for the heart, but having that strength component is actually really, really important for the heart capacity and the heart preventing heart disease and heart attacks as well.
Yeah. And I liked your analogy from the Hawaiian study about 2.5 X versus 10%. So that's a big difference. And I will say something and tell me if I'm right. It's basically saying spend more time lifting weight than doing endurance. That will provide more dividends for your longevity. That's fair to say.
Yeah, so you get more bang from your buck from high intensity than low intensity is basically what it means. So even if you're somebody who likes to or who only can really get out and walk, just doing really trying to go walk as fast as you can at an uncomfortably fast level is going to have more benefit to you, or walking upstairs or something that gives you more resistance or more of a challenge is going to be more beneficial to you than somebody who just goes at a very easy pace. And that's true both for the neurocognitive as well as the cardiac effects. Because we know that the neurocognitive effects, because if you just take people and you have them do self-selected speed and they exercise at a self-selected speed, it doesn't actually have any effect on neurocognitive disease like Alzheimer's or Parkinson's type disease. But if you have them go faster than they're comfortable, so they're going at what we call an overspeed, they actually have an improvement in function that's equal to the best medicines that are available. So what you have to do is you have to, from time to time, get outside of that comfort zone. So go faster than you feel like going, both for our brains, but also for our hearts. And then that'll also, because you're going harder against a greater resistance, that'll also give you a greater stimulus to your skeletal muscle to get stronger in those areas as well.
Awesome. I'm going to pivot into some of your research as we were talking about before. There's so much that we want to dig into. You've had such a prolific career, so we're probably just going to scratch the surface. But your PhD work focused on the effect of resistance exercise on specific molecular markers related to muscle growth. During this time, you made that landmark discovery that the mammalian target of rapamycin, mTOR complex 1, was activated in response to resistance training, and that activation was proportional to the load across the muscle. So I would love if you could give our listeners a bit more background describing that work, what mTOR is, as well as its significance.
Sure. So what this complex is, this mTOR complex 1, is it's probably, to people who like longevity, they already know that it's going to be the mechanistic target of rapamycin. And rapamycin is this drug that is probably the best biologic that has been developed for increasing longevity. And so what the interesting thing is that taking rapamycin is, yet the primary reason that it's good for longevity is it's going to blunt a lot of this baseline increasing of inflammatory signals that are going on in the body. What we discovered during my PhD is that when you lift a heavy weight in the skeletal muscle that you are working, you're going to activate mTOR complex 1. And that's directly proportional to the increase in muscle mass that you're going to get. And so if I want to build a bigger, stronger muscle, I need to be able to turn mTOR on within that muscle at specific times, at least a few times a week. And so that's then now contrasted with the idea of, I just said that muscle strength is really important for longevity in people. Then strength is going to be, you need to turn on mTOR, but then this longevity drug turns off mTOR. So that's where this really real complexity within the system comes in. And really what happens is that when we lift a heavy weight, when we do some sort of an activity, and the opposite is actually true when we do endurance exercise, but we can talk about that later. If you lift a heavy weight, I'm turning on mTOR within my skeletal muscle. If I do enough weightlifting or if I do enough exercise that I've changed the metabolism within my body, I will simultaneously turn off mTOR in my liver and I'll turn off mTOR in my adipose tissue. And then there's going to be signals that also reach the brain that turn on mTOR in the brain. So what we get isn't just one spot where we get activation or inactivation. And so what we get is a combination of things that are physiologically this perfect storm, where we're turning on mTOR in a place where we're going to grow that muscle. We're turning off mTOR in places where it has metabolic, it has potential for oncogenic. It has other potentials within your body, and we're turning it off in those locations. So we're actually serving a little bit like a non-pharmaceutical rapamycin when we do these types of things. The same thing is actually true with endurance exercise. So when we do endurance exercise, we're actually turning off mTOR in a lot of different places within our body because it's a huge metabolic stress. We're using lots of energy to run or to walk or to go up it, to hike or to do whatever our activity is. And in doing that, what happens is that a lot of the tissues that are normally seeing lots and lots of blood flow and lots of nutrients, they're seeing much less of the much less of that nutrient. mTOR gets turned off in response to that. So when I go out and I do, say I go out on a big bike ride and I ride a bike for an hour, and what I'm getting is I'm getting within my body lots of areas where mTOR is turned off, a few areas like in my brain where it's turned on. When I lift a heavy weight, I'm going to get in the muscles that I've exercised. I'm turning mTOR on in those muscles. And that's going to be really important because it's going to give me a bigger muscle. And I'm also simultaneously turning off in places where it's not necessarily as good for my health and longevity. Yeah, and so that's where that physiological component of it comes in. Sorry.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And tissue specific is definitely, I assume, what's happening. And it's not like mTOR is good in only good or only bad. It's the balance between tissues and timing. So my question is about rapamycin. In a way, it's supposed to inhibit mTOR all over the body. So how can we explain that in comparison to what you explained to us, that it's all tissue specific?
Right. So the level of rapamycin, first of all, for that people use for longevity is much lower than they would use for rejection of a kidney, for example, because that's where rapamycin was traditionally used, is when you got an organ transplant, because there would be an autoimmune response, you would use rapamycin to block the autoimmune response. So in that situation, there's a big immune signal, you need a high rapamycin level. When you're taking it for longevity, it should be a very, very small dose. And it's really a small dose and is going to do primarily what we're doing when we're trying to prevent kidney rejection. What it's doing is it's decreasing the global inflammatory signal, because the inflammatory system, or the inflammatory cells, they need rapamycin to grow and to have an immune response.
Yeah.
Well, when we have excess in nutrients, or so dietary excess, or we have all of these different things happening, or we have stress, what we tend to get as we get older is the inflammatory signals within our body tend to get higher. And that can lead to a number of different problems within our body. So type 2 diabetes, again, is a very strong inflammatory signal there. Osteoarthritis, rheumatoid arthritis, all of these signals are very strong inflammatory signals. So if we have a low dose of rapamycin to bring those down, the idea of the low dose is it's low enough, it can bring down basal throughout the whole body. But then if I do something specific, like I lift a weight with my legs, it shouldn't necessarily inhibit. Experiments haven't been done to really show this sufficiently, but it shouldn't necessarily inhibit the ability of that muscle to grow. We do know that rapamycin does have some negative effects on skeletal muscle, even at the low dose that's used for longevity, but it also has the ability to overcome some of the negative components as you get into these advancing age situations. So what we say is that, look, rapamycin is a drug that people use. People can use it, but if you're going to go out and you're going to do, say, an hour of endurance exercise or a little bit of a day, you're not going to need the rapamycin, because that hour of endurance exercise is probably going to do more of the anti-inflammatory. It's probably going to give you more of that overall positive signal than that rapamycin that's going to give you the same signal throughout your whole body is going to get for your adaptations and for your longevity.
Okay. And we interviewed Nir Barzilai, which I assume that you know, a few weeks ago. And what he said about those drugs is it's not only the tissue specific, it's also the age of the person. And he said that in his opinion, consuming rapamycin or metformin, it might be good for the elderly, but it's definitely not good. Let's go back to your analogy of, I don't know, LeBron James. The NBA player shouldn't take it. It's more for longevity, and you should take it in the older age when the system is not. Do you agree with this statement?
Yeah, so there's really good data on metformin that it doesn't really work if you're not in a disease state. So if you're a totally healthy person, you've got a normal BMI, you're reaching physical activity guidelines, there's no benefit to having metformin. There's a number of different studies that have shown that. Again, something similar is going to be present for rapamycin. What you do is you use those if you are, the reason that we would have them is if you're unable or unwilling to exercise. And hopefully it's that you're unable to exercise because you have something else. That's another tool in your toolbox that has a similar function to some degree, but it doesn't have the same overall function as doing that exercise component.
Sounds good.
And how about it being proportional to the load of, let's say, weight or resistance that you would put on your muscles?
So when we first did the experiments, we would do it so that we would have a much heavier load on certain muscles than on other muscles. And so what we could do is we could actually see the muscles that worked the hardest got the biggest mTOR signal. But as we go back and we look at that data in hindsight, what we realize is that part of what we were seeing there was the mTOR signal, but part of what we were seeing was the injury to the muscle. So the harder the muscle worked, the higher the load was, the more injury, the more damage there was to the muscle because the muscle had never done that exercise before. So when you have a lot of damage, you're going to get an immune response. The immune system is going to, when we take out a muscle and we just powder it and we look at what the mTOR activity, now if it has lots of immune cells in there that have been activated, it's going to have a higher immune system or higher mTOR signal. And so what that would suggest to us is that part of what we were seeing was that the heavier load led to more injury. The more injury also was a contributing factor to the increase in mTOR levels. But we do know that even after you've done lots of exercise, you're not getting as much injury, you're still going to get an activation of mTOR. The other thing that we know is that if you then supplement with a protein source, the protein is also going to activate mTOR, but it does it in a different way. And so the result is that the resistance exercise activates mTOR the same way that, say, insulin or IGF-1 would. The amino acids activate mTOR in a different way. The two things sum up to be to activate mTOR to a greater degree. And the result is when you lift weights with protein, you get a bigger muscle. Okay, so we do know that the mTOR is important for that growth, but it's that initial signal that we found in the first paper was probably an overestimation as to what happens, just because what we were also seeing was that we were getting injury there.
Yeah. So question about the protein. This is, in my opinion, $1 billion question because everyone is asking, what is the timing to take the protein when you exercise? Yeah. Is it really there is a window of 1 or 2 hours? And if you can elaborate on that, I think that there is a lot of confusion.
Yeah. So in young active people, there's not really a window. So even 24 hours later, if I exercise, if when I was 25, if I exercised yesterday, I would still have higher protein synthesis in those muscles that I exercise today. As we get older, if we get to a point where we have more insulin resistance, the need for combining the exercise and the nutrition becomes higher. The way that I explain it is that if I eat something and I'm totally at rest, it's basically when you eat something, it's a message to the body. But if you eat something and you're resting, the message doesn't have any address. So it's not going to go anywhere specific. So where it go, it'll go to liver, and then it'll store kind of everywhere, mostly into adipose and a little bit in the skeletal muscle. If I exercise, even just small amounts of exercise, what I've done is I've put an address on where that protein or where that nutrient is going to go. So what's going to happen is if I exercise, I get a 20-fold increase in blood flow to the working muscle. So now what that means is if I take in any protein or I take in any food, now that blood flow is going to go to that working muscle for a lot longer. You know that if you guys are on college campuses, if you walk past the gym on Friday afternoon, the gym is full on Friday afternoon. It's full of guys. It's full of guys because they know that if they lift weights Friday afternoon, when they go out to the bar on Friday night, their t-shirt's going to be a little bit tighter because there's more blood flow to the muscle and they're going to look bigger and stronger in their t-shirt. That same principle of the increased blood flow for a few hours after exercise is what we're going to take advantage of if we don't have as good of insulin signaling or other things. So if we're insulin resistant, as we get older, we tend to get more insulin resistant. Now, when I exercise, what I'm doing is by eating close to that exercise afterwards, now more of what I just ate is going to go to the muscles that I've just exercised. Okay, so the lab that I'm in here, the guy says that he spent 30 million euros to prove that his mom was right, because basically what he knows is that we are what we eat, because he can give intrinsically labeled protein and see it turn up in the muscle. And then what he knows is that if you exercise, you're more of what you just ate. So what we do, what our exercise is doing is it's targeting our amino acids and our proteins to, or our amino acids to the muscles that were exercised. And so that's why a swimmer is going to have big back muscles and no leg muscles. And a cyclist is going to have the reverse, because what they've done is by training one muscle group specifically, they're delivering more nutrients to that group. If you are an older person and you're trying to compete you're competing against get death, basically. What you want to do is you want to work a lot of your muscle mass. And then if you deliver some amino acids or protein near that exercise, you're then going to deliver more of that substance to your muscles. So you'll get more of that made into muscle protein. So the window isn't really in existence in early life if you're active and healthy. It becomes more important as you get older, as you become more insulin resistant.
And then what is the window? Is it 2 hours? Is it 4 hours? Or it's not?
We would try and do something where it's going to be within about an hour if you want to take advantage of the blood flow component. Okay. If you're trying to deliver it in a way that's going to be delivered straight to the muscles that you've exercised, it's the best beneficial time is as close to the exercise as possible. So what we do... And there, what you're also looking for is something that's easy to digest and absorb. So you don't want to necessarily have a steak right after you exercise. What you want to do is have something that's easy to absorb, easy to digest. And that can be any type of, you could have it as a milk. You could have it as anything that's going to easily get digested and absorbed. And again, that's something that becomes impaired to some degree as we get older.
Okay. That's good to know. And what do you think about the isolated protein? That's necessary, or in your opinion, it's not?
So if you have something like whey protein is just, there's two proteins in milk. There's the casein and the whey. The whey is just the acid soluble. So when we talk about it being easy to digest, the acid soluble gets through the stomach really quickly. Whereas the casein, that's the other protein, it forms the curds. That's, you know, that's basically what it does. And so it doesn't get digested very quickly. So when you're looking at a whole food protein like milk, it's going to get digested just fine. The whey protein or some isolated protein, maybe a little bit faster. Is it worth the price? Probably not. Probably the whole food, something easy to digest, is just as good.
Thank you so much. That was very beneficial for our audience.
Yeah. I want to go back to the mTOR discussion quickly. Two questions on it. So if you're a newer exerciser, let's say you're starting, you're doing research in a population that doesn't exercise, those are always the best results that we see. You know, when you look at exercise studies from people that don't exercise, I wish I could get results like that, but I'm not starting from zero. So their increase in mTOR activation is a lot higher. Do you see a proportional, you know, shut off, so to speak, in the other parts of the body that's also proportionally higher than people that exercise regularly?
It's a greater metabolic stress a lot of times, because your body doesn't, it's not as efficient about the movement. So if you're going to go out and you're going to do a run, as you get better at running, you become a little bit more efficient in everything that you do. And so the result is that you don't have all of the other extra movements that are going on. And so the rest of your body wouldn't necessarily get the same, would get probably a little bit higher signal. When we have an older population, especially, if we start an exercise program, so we start lifting weights, the mTOR activation, it's not exactly it's not doing the same thing. It is doing, it's turning on protein synthesis. But the way I explain it to my students is that if I give you $100,000 to modify your house, if your house is in perfect condition, you can do something like maybe add a room and you can build out a room. I know in California, maybe not, but we could build out a room and we could have a little bit bigger house, right? That's basically what we're doing when we exercise, when we lift a heavy weight. But if I give you that same $100,000, just as a tree falls on your house and it collapses the roof in, what you have to do is you have to spend that $100,000 to repair your house to get it back to where it was. So when we take a young muscle, we're not going to get as much injury in that muscle from that exercise. We can add the extra room onto that house. We take an old muscle because of the structure of the old muscle, because it's not as good at transmitting the force. What happens is it gets injured to a much greater degree than a young muscle from doing the same exercise. And the result is that instead of using that mTOR signal to build out a bigger house or a bigger structure, like a bigger muscle, what we have to do is we have to repair that muscle. Mm-hmm. And so you have to approach it at a much slower rate when you have an older individual. And some of our research, what we show is that if I look at an old muscle and I look at a young muscle and I look at a protein that everybody knows the name of, which is dystrophin, in an old muscle, you actually have less dystrophin in the muscle than you did when you were young. So what that means, and if you picture a boy with muscular dystrophy, they have non-functional muscles because the muscle fibers don't stick together very well. And so they slide and then they produce injury to the muscle fibers, and then they have to go through regeneration constantly. As we get older, we all become dystrophic. And that is a process as well, that if we're not using our muscles as frequently, it becomes an accelerated process. And so every time that, we tell somebody, oh, you should go out and exercise. If they go out and they do an exercise thing with somebody who they saw on YouTube or maybe not your listeners or your viewers, because maybe that's not their source of information. But if they go to some personal trainer who is then going to give them the same program they gave to a 30-year-old, what they're going to do is they're going to have so much more damage. They're going to have so much more injury that it's going to actually not give them the signal that it's going to get better. And so you have to start and you have to progress much, much, much more slowly in an older individual. If you're starting, you can grow a muscle, you can grow strength really well. The thing you want to do is you want to ramp it up much, much slower, because they're much more prone to injury at the beginning period. Because if you've been inactive and old, now you've got much less dystrophin. The result is that every time you use your muscle at a high level, you're going to have a lot more injury than somebody who's younger or than somebody who's been using their muscle more continuously. So all of these things go together, because again, the mTOR signal is going to be proportional to the load, but it's also proportional to the injury. So it's actually, you're probably going to get a bigger one to some degree in some of the old muscles. And we've seen that. It just doesn't last as long. And the protein synthetic response doesn't last as long. And so what that means is we're regenerating it. We're trying to build it back to where it was rather than building a bigger structure. And so we have to be a little bit more patient as we're older to kind of ramp up into our exercise so that we don't just injure ourselves and not really see benefits.
Gotcha. I'm in a 100-year-old house, so I feel that, because it'd be cheaper to knock the whole thing down, honestly.
This one's 400. This one's 400 years here, so.
Amazing.
The beams are supposed to not actually have wood in them anymore because they fossilized. That's what we were told.
So. Wow.
Difference.
Well, if focusing too on like endurance versus resistance training, do we, is that also eliciting as much of a, like, turning off mTOR in other places? Is that explaining some of the 250% versus 10% of an impact on reaching 100?
As a Longevity by Design podcast listener, you understand the value of improving your health for today and for all the years ahead. And if you want to live your healthiest, longest life possible, you need to understand what's going on inside. At Inside Tracker, we take a personalized approach to health span optimization that eliminates guesswork from your wellness plan. Inside Tracker analyzes blood biomarker and DNA data, along with physiomarker data from fitness trackers like Oura Ring, to deliver personalized food, supplement, lifestyle, and exercise recommendations that allow you to take control and improve your health span. And for a limited time, Longevity by Design listeners can get 20% off at the Inside Tracker store. So if you're ready to receive a personal health analysis and data-driven wellness plan to optimize your body for the long haul, then it's time to start inside. Visit insidetracker.com/podcast to get started today. That's insidetracker.com/podcast to get started today.
Yeah. So the endurance exercise component is interesting because if we just take the main molecular signal for endurance exercise, so when we do endurance exercise, it's a metabolic stress. We're going to get things like more mitochondria in our muscle. We're going to increase mitophagy, another thing that's really important for aging. We're going to get more capillaries going to that muscle. We're going to get more enzymes for fat and glucose oxidation. And all of those things can be controlled by one gene. It's PDC1-alpha, which is important for endurance adaptations. Metformin, if it is able to turn on AMP kinase in muscle, what it's going to do is it's going to give you more PDC1-alpha. Now, that PDC1-alpha, we know that if you increase its expression in animals, they live longer. They live a little bit longer, but their quality of life, you look at them, they look younger for a much longer period of time. And so that's a really interesting finding, but we're not extending their life a huge amount with that. And that's really the core thing that we're getting in the muscle. The interesting thing is that it doesn't necessarily it's going to have an effect in the heart as well. This is going to have a beneficial effect for those who have heart issues, and is going to definitely control mTOR activity in the liver and adipose tissue. So it will have a lot of those benefits. I don't think that there's going to be I can't explain the 250% versus 10% effect on longevity just from say mTOR as a single thing, but you will see that beneficial effect. It's just not going to be on the longevity component, but it's going to be, you can see the quality, everything from stem cell quality. So there's a guy named Mark Tarapalski in Canada, and he's not only a great sports physician, but he's also a great athlete himself. And what he realized is everybody kept telling him how young he looked. And he was like, well, maybe there's something about exercise and stem cells in the skin. So he did a study where he got skin biopsies off of people's buttocks because he figured that that was an area where there wouldn't be sun damage and there wouldn't be any issues like that. And so what he found is that the stem cell quality was significantly better in those people who had exercised in the skin. And so you see all kinds of different, and it was endurance-based exercise there. So you do see all of these kind of things that would be indicative of quality of life or life or health span that are improved by the endurance exercise. We just don't see. So when John Halsey did a really long intervention in rats where he exercised them throughout their whole life, he increased their life about 7%. So it's a good effect, but it's not necessarily as big of an effect as you would see with strength training or some other. Or rapamycin, I think, is about 16% improvement in longevity. We see with a ketogenic diet, we get about a 13% improvement in longevity. So it gives you a good effect, but it's not as big as some of the other interventions.
Sure. Thank you.
Okay,
we got very off script.
Yeah, no, that's good. That was a great discussion. And yep. I think that, again, due to a lack of time, and maybe in the future we'll invite you to another episode, maybe we'll shift gears and discuss a bit about, talk about exercise, nutrition, ligament, and aging. And as Ashley mentioned very nicely in the introduction, in addition to muscle, a big focus of your work is on understanding the molecular mechanism of tendon ligament development and the role of exercise and nutrition on their health and function. Mm-hmm. So maybe I don't think that it's a point that we ever discussed in this podcast before. So can you maybe start by defining what are ligaments? What are tendons? How do you connect a muscle into the bones? I think that's a fascinating point that I'm not sure that a lot of people are paying a lot of attention on that. And I think that it's a major reason or cause of injuries, as much as
Absolutely.
I know.
Absolutely. So everybody understands as soon as it happens to them. So basically a ligament is a tissue that attaches two bones together. So at a joint, like an the anterior cruciate ligament that we hear a lot about in sports, that keeps the knee from going forward and backward. So, or at least forward. So a ligament is bone to bone. A tendon attaches a muscle to a bone. Now, it's fairly similar. The structures look very similar. It's hard to tell them on a microscope that one's a tendon, one's a ligament. But if you think about it, one is attaching a very soft thing, like a muscle to a bone, which is very hard. And a ligament attaches two bones, which are both very hard. And so they have to have different mechanical functions. And that's one of the really interesting things about this. And the most, this comes to our attention most frequently when we look at men versus women. So most people have a bit of an understanding that women are about four times more likely to rupture their ACL. So they have this instability in the knee. And so that's the one thing that people know. Well, what most people don't know is that they're about 60% less likely to get a muscle pull. So what that gives us is an idea as to what's happening here. So a muscle, because it's soft and it goes to a hard structure in a bone, the tendon has to actually have a soft end and a stiff end. So it has to have a stretchy end and a stiff end. Whereas a ligament, what it does is it's supposed to stop a joint from moving. So the stiffer it is, the better. But if your tendon becomes stiffer than your muscle is strong, you're going to pull the muscle. So what we see in women is we get fewer muscle pulls and we get more ligament injuries. And what that means is that there's lower stiffness overall in women before menopause. And what we've done so what we can do in our lab is we actually engineer little human ligaments. They're little engineered ACLs that use people's ACL cells after they've gone up to Tahoe to go skiing. If they rupture their knee ligaments, they'll come down to UC Davis to get them repaired. We get the little remnant of the ACL. We can isolate the cells and we can make little engineered ligaments. And when we treat them with physiological high levels of estrogen, what you see is you actually see a decrease in stiffness at what you would see during the luteal surge where estrogen goes high. And what we see is we see an increase in compliance or a decrease in stiffness. And so stiffness of these tissues is dependent on the protein that's there, and that's collagen, but how well connected those proteins are through this cross-linking that happens through an enzyme called lysyl oxidase. And what we know now, what we discovered in our little ligaments is that when we treated them with the estrogen, what would happen is the lysyl oxidase would get inhibited. And it was an 80% inhibition of this enzyme that cross-linked or the collagen, and that stiffens collagen. And so for tendon and ligament, that's interesting because that means that tells us why women get fewer muscle pulls and more ligament injuries, because every 30 days or so, you've got this surge of estrogen, you decrease stiffness, and now your tissues are less stiff. That's great for preventing a muscle pull, but it's not good for preventing an ACL rupture. But it also is going to explain to us why women have, on average, lower blood pressure than men. Because in our aorta, we've got a collagen structure, and that collagen becomes cross-linked. And if estrogen is circulating the same way that it's going to circulate for our tendons and ligaments, it means that the collagen within that structure is going to be more stretchy. And the result is that men are going to have higher and women are going to have lower blood pressure on average. So we can begin to understand these things as far as how these structures are regulated. And then what we did is we tried to figure out what was the best type of exercise for these, that we need to exercise them the same way we exercise our muscles and our heart. And what we figured out and what we learned very quickly was that our tendon cells and our ligament cells are very much like my 16-year-old daughter, where she'll listen to me for about 5 minutes or so, and then she'll tune out and she won't really get anything. So as we exercise our tendons and ligaments, within about 5 minutes, the signal goes up and then it comes down, even if we keep exercising. And it takes about 8 hours before we can do that signal again. So for our connective tissues, it's actually best to do very short, 5-6 minutes of activity, with about 6 to 8 hours of rest. And so that was interesting, but it was in a little tissue. We've just finished a study because one of the people who found out about our work was a rock climber. He was a professional rock climber. His brother found out about it from a physical therapist because we had put together a training program to improve tendon health. And so rock climbers have really bad tendon health in their hands. And so they developed a program based on that. And they put it out there, and he was the rock climber is also a professional YouTuber. And so that YouTube video had been seen by about 1 million people. And so people started doing this workout, and then they use a climbing app to track their workouts. And so we just went into the climbing app to see people who did this very low intensity exercise versus really heavy exercise. And they just loaded in this different way, which is a small amount of load over about a 6 to 10 minute period. And what we found is that they increased their finger strength and their finger health, as well as people who lifted huge amounts of weight. So what it tells us is that if we're getting older, what we want to do is we don't want to load the same way that we loaded our muscles and tendons when we were younger. What we want to do is we want to do slower movements. We don't have to lift as heavy a weight. And what we can do is simple things that are what we call isometric holds. And that just means that I can keep the ankle at the same position, resist, and that's really going to give me a great signal for my tendons and ligaments. And so we do a lot of this for people who have tennis elbow or golfer's elbow, because again, that's basically a tennis elbow. You have the tendon that's on the outside of your elbow is inflamed. Golfer's elbow, it's the tendon on the inside of your elbow. And all you have to do is load that for 30 seconds on an isometric contraction. Just basically, you put your tennis racket under a table and you try and turn your hand one way or the other, depending on which one you have. And you hold it for 30 seconds. You do that 4 times with 2 minutes of rest in between. And sure enough, most of those tendon injuries go away. And so if people have knee injuries, if people are knee pain or back pain or things like that, just by doing these longer holds, they're able to actually repair the tendons. And we've got data actually from the shirt that I'm wearing right now, the team that's there, their owners, we work with them because they have an interest in sports performance. And so we had been working with some of their athletes, and one of their athletes had a big hole in the middle of his tendon, and we were able to fix it using these types of loads. And so the idea is that as we get older, especially when our tendons and ligaments become, they've built up a lot of injury over time, that we need to do these longer holds, the things you kind of see in the power poses in yoga or other stuff like that, that actually are going to give you a huge signal for your tendons and ligaments to actually retain a lot of their youthful capacity.
That's very interesting and unexpected, at least to me. So I have millions of follow-up questions. The first one, which you said, which is interesting, I love to doing yoga, and I feel like yoga is helping me after, and now I understand why, because there is not a real logic explanation why yoga is good, but and stretching, but and now you explain exactly why stretching is good, correct?
Yeah, so it's not necessarily the yoga stretch that's the positive part of it. It's the part where you're struggling, where you're holding, say you're doing a warrior pose. And you're getting deep into the warrior pose, and you've got your knee and your hip are both at 90 degrees, and you're holding it and you're starting to shake. That is the thing that's outstanding for your tendons and ligaments within those joints. And so the key thing that we have to do is we're looking to say, if I've got a shoulder problem and I've got a little bit of tightness in my shoulder or a problem with my rotator cuff, what I want to do is I want to go and I want to say, okay, I can feel out. Oh yeah. That's when I push forward from here, this is where I feel it and I get tension across there or I get pain. So now what I want to do is I just want to push just light enough so I can feel the tension, but I don't feel the pain, and hold it there for 30 seconds. Relax, do it again. And within a few weeks to a month, that shoulder, that if it's not a rupture and if there's still tissue there, it can actually repair itself and it can actually regain the strength that it had. So That's again, the core of the yoga isn't necessarily the static stretch where I'm trying to get my toes or something. Yeah. But what it is, it's those poses where you're getting down into a position and you're having your muscle work and to hold a specific position for a longer period of time.
Makes sense. Another point that you raised, which was very interesting and didn't know about it, is a premenopausal women with a ACL injury. So if the logic is right, postmenopausal women are like male. That's correct.
It's interesting because they're different. They're different than premenopausal women, and this is really one of the. Again, it's very difficult to do the research because nobody gives tendons and ligaments. There's two labs in the world where they take tendon biopsies because it's not something that's done. So one is Michael Kerr in Copenhagen, and one of his former students, Mette Hansen, up in Aarhus, both in Denmark. That's probably not a coincidence. So what they do is, and what Mette has shown in her work, she's done lots of things with premenopausal. She's done things with women on oral contraceptives. She's done exercise in postmenopausal women. And interestingly, the effect that she gets in premenopausal women is actually the opposite of that she gets in postmenopausal women. And then the other interesting thing is that when you extend it to say that not only are we talking about postmenopausal women, but if you have breast cancer that are estrogen receptor positive breast cancer patients, what they're getting put on is they get put on an aromatase inhibitor, which prevents the conversion of testosterone to estrogen. And when we do these experiments in our little ligaments, estrogen decreases stiffness, testosterone increases stiffness. And when you put in the aromatase inhibitor with testosterone, you actually get a big drop in the stiffness and the strength of the ligaments. And so I have a friend who's an oncologist, and what she was asking me is, why do all these women who have ER-positive breast cancer suddenly get all these joint pain when I put them onto aromatase inhibitors? And it looks like it's inhibiting some of these hormones from doing what they're supposed to do on the tendon and ligament.
Interesting. And another focus of your lab is working on or understanding collagen synthesis and the tendons. So can you describe that a bit and why collagen is so important?
Yeah, so collagen is a protein, is the most common protein in our body. But as we get older, we decrease the rate at which we synthesize it. And the reason that I'm in the Netherlands right now is because the lab that I'm in, Luc van Loon's lab in the Netherlands, what he does is he studies kind of the effects of nutrients on turnover of proteins within different tissues of the body. He's done it in healthy brain tissue. He does tons of it in muscle. And in muscle, he's shown that none of the nutrients that you give, whether you give, protein or you give a big meal, you give whatever, it doesn't seem to affect connective tissue protein synthesis in skeletal muscle. What we don't know is whether it has any effect on tendon and ligament. And so what we're doing here is we're actually taking people who have ruptured their ACL. They're coming in for surgery. They're coming in to have the hamstring tendon used to replace the ACL. And so when you do that, that's a hamstring autograft. Basically, they take out a big, long piece of the hamstring. They fold it over. They make a new ACL. At the bottom of that, there's a little piece of tendon that they cut off. And we are actually taking that, and we're going to use that to see, we're going to measure the incorporation of deuterated water, which is just a way that we can tell newly synthesized proteins in that tendon. We're giving half of the people a supplement that has some dietary collagen and vitamin C in it, and the other half are just serving as control. And this should be one of the first studies that actually measures how much collagen turnover there is within a tendon, within a hamstring tendon, and whether that can be regulated by nutrition.
Okay.
But it's still early days.
And you mentioned vitamin C, and I heard one of your discussion that vitamin C can be a good vitamin to basically help you build. I think that it was more muscle than a tendon.
No, it would be more connective tissue because it's okay. A requirement. So if we want to make collagen, so our cells make collagen, but collagen's like a rope, and you don't necessarily want to make a rope inside of your cells because if it gets assembled within there, it's going to actually kill the cell. So what you have to do is you have to process it and you have to send it out of the cell or into a special compartment where it can get incorporated into the matrix. Vitamin C is absolutely essential to the processing and the movement of that collagen protein out of the cell. So if we don't have vitamin C, we don't actually produce collagen and add collagen into the matrix. And so that's why the disease scurvy existed back in when people went on long voyages. And the first ever nutrition experiment was done by a Scottish doctor who basically took 10 sailors and gave two of them like two of them got poison. I know that two of them got like turpentine, and they would drink all of these different things. And two of them got lemons and I think a lemon and a lime. And the ones that got the lemon and the lime got better. And that's why the British always had lemons and limes, and people call them limeys because they would always travel with them because that was their source of vitamin C. But the scurvy was that their scars would open up, that their teeth would fall out, their hair would fall out, because that's what happens when you have absolutely no collagen synthesis. You need the vitamin C in order to get some. And what we do is when we're trying to increase vitamin C, when we're trying to increase the synthesis of new collagen, we want to make sure that there's sufficient amounts of vitamin C there.
And when should a person consume a collagen supplement?
There's not necessarily, so what we would say right now is that there's not great evidence that if you're just an active, normal person that you need to do it. There's maybe a little bit of evidence that says that if you have something like osteoarthritis or you have some sort of injury where there's been an increase to some degree of collagen or a problem with collagen turnover, that it can be helpful. But it's still really early days as far as the science of collagen supplementation. And so we can show that having collagen supplementation can have an effect in people, but whether that's a consistent finding, it's just too early to know. So for most people, I wouldn't necessarily say it's got to be there, but if you're really active, if you are recovering from injuries, then there's no negative side of it. And there's not really, I can't point to anything specifically that it is doing that we can identify at a molecular level yet. And that's really what makes me less confident in it. But I still think that there is a place for it within a healthy diet.
Okay. But what you're saying that most of us absorb it from the food. So why use
most that? Of us, if we're not vegetarian, vegan, we're gonna get most of what we need from our food. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's basically for meat, I assume. Meat and fish.
Because all of the gristly bits of the meat are where you're going to get the dietary collagen. Yeah.
Okay. So my next question is, there are a lot of misconceptions and confusion regarding ligament health. And do you have any misconception that you would like to clarify to our audience?
So they think the biggest thing is that people think that these are tissues that don't repair, that you can't fix. Even though an ACL rupture, there's a group in Australia that does cross bracing that just holds the knee at a specific angle, lets the two ends of the ligament come together, and it actually repairs just as well as a surgical repair. So there's this idea that we have to go in and surgically repair any type of tendon or ligament injury, because the thought is that these are inert tissues and all they are ropes. And so if the ropes aren't connected, we just need to tie them back together. That's really not true. They actually turn over faster than our skeletal muscle does. They actually have a greater rate of turnover than skeletal muscle. And so if you have tendon or ligament injury, as long as there is a connection there, you should be able to repair that structure. And so I think that that's probably the most important thing that most people will understand.
And that's an important point, because I always say that when you provide a hammer to someone that like to hammer, he will hammer. So when you go to a surgeon and showing something, most likely say, "Oh, you need to have an operation." Be careful from that.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
I have a question about joint replacements.
Sure.
Like, in pain for those is, you have to reattach the tendons to the muscle, or the muscle to the joint. But what about the ligaments? What happens with
those? So you don't have to reattach the tendons, because the tendons stay intact. So the patellar tendon, all they're going to do is they're going to move the patella out of the way. They're going to come in and take the top off the tibial plateau and replace that. And then they're going to take the bottom off the femoral head. And so basically, as they're doing that, they're pulling the tendons apart and they're just going into the space there. So even some of the extrinsic ligaments, so the lateral and the medial, the collateral ligaments, can actually still be in place in a knee replacement. So what you're going to get is you're going to get a structure that is titanium with some sort of hydroxyapatite on it to make it attach to the bone better. And then what's going to happen is it's going to use it. Basically, the structure of the replacement joint has a replacement for the ACL in there, has a replacement for the other intrinsic ligaments within the knee. But the only thing you're really replacing are the heads. But there, it's a very good opportunity for us in the lab I'm in now to get lots of different tissues and to measure their turnover and to measure how nutrients affect how quickly they turn over. Because we can give people the deuterated water for a week before, and we can give them different interventions as far as, you know, maybe protein, collagen, whatever we want to give them. And then when they go in for surgery, we get all of the tissues. So we get an ACL, we get the cartilage, we get the bone, we get all kinds of different things. And we can see the turnover of all of those different tissues.
That's very interesting. And just to start wrapping it up. First of all, a very fascinating discussion. And my question is, what excites you or interests you the most that has the potential to extend the health span or lifespan in the next 5 to 10 years?
Yeah, so I think there's a lot of things that are really interesting. And as far as what we're looking at is from the point of view of the musculoskeletal system. So one of our recent papers, we discovered a drug that actually improved tendon function. And the interesting thing is it's a drug that's important or involved in an anti-inflammatory component of what's happening. So the idea is that maybe something like that drug can increase the ability of more and more people to remain active, because a lot of people stop doing the things that they love to do because, oh, I had to stop running because my knee hurt, or, oh, I had to stop doing this, because that's the component of the lifespan part of it that's really important to me, because that extending the period when you can do all of the things that you want to do, chase little kids around and do all of those fun things in life, that's the part that we're trying to extend. We're not trying to extend the ability to sit in a bed and have our heart beating and our brain functioning to some degree. We want to be able to do all the things that we love doing for as long as possible. And so the idea that we can actually physically change the makeup of the joint to make it more robust for a longer period of time, to allow people to do activities that they love to do for a long period of time, that has huge potential, and it's completely understudied.
Yeah. And can you tell us what is this drug, or it's still?
I'm not sure. It's one of the JAK inhibitors. So, and we've used different FDA approved JAK inhibitors, and they have that effect. And so they're used clinically for rheumatoid arthritis. They're used for psoriasis and other skin problems. But what we're starting to do is to look at whether these could be used as a way to improve joint function.
And you expect to apply it topically or apply it orally?
So far what we're doing is we're looking at an oral delivery, but there's all kinds of possibilities, especially if the tendon in question or the joint in question is close to the surface and easy to access. But if it's an internal structure, or if it's a synovial joint, it becomes a little bit more difficult to get it in if we're just going to do it topically.
That's very exciting, and looking forward to hear about it. I know so many people that have a joint problem that can be literally a game changer.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And Keith, the last question that we always ask is, what is your top tip for a health span?
So basically, top tip for health span is to exercise, first of all, and to do it at least a few times a week at an intensity that's much higher than we would do it comfortably. So if you go at a self-selected pace, it's going to be okay. If you go harder than you'd like to go because you're chasing a little critter around and you're having a great time running after them, that's going to be much, much better if you find yourself out of breath. And then the core of that, and the key that for us, is that making sure that all of your structures work properly so that you can do that. And so doing the biggest game changer, I think, for most people is getting into a position where we're just feeling tension across those joints that are giving us pain, hold that tension for 30 seconds, do that two or three times, maybe even four times, try it on both sides, and that's going to allow you to have much more of the mobility that you want moving forward.
Yeah, that's definitely a unique and a very interesting suggestion. So thank you so much for that. And thank you so much for all the amazing information that you provide to us today. You're and as I said before, we hope that we can invite you in the future to cover the other points that we haven't had the time to cover today. Thank you so much, and I appreciate your wisdom.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks for listening to Longevity by Design. Please subscribe to this podcast on Apple, Spotify, or YouTube. Longevity by Design is powered by Inside Tracker, a personalized health optimization platform that helps people improve their lives by improving their bodies from the inside out using personalized, science-backed recommendations for nutrition, supplements, and lifestyle changes. To learn more, visit InsideTracker.com/podcast.